Welcome to The Open Line, a deeper dive into the stories and events of our community and the world at large. Interesting discussion and healthy debate on the topics that matter to you. Join the conversation. 519-376-7777. The Open Line on 560 CFOS.
Good morning. Welcome to The Open Line. I'm Claire McCormack, and with me today are two of my guests from the Nuclear Innovation Institute, Chief Innovation Officer Dr. Eric Johnston and President and CEO of the NII, as it's often called, Bruce Wallace. Welcome and good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Yeah.
We're not going to do the weather, Claire.
No, it's sunny out.
Sunny and a little cold, actually. A little cold.
Yeah. It's a little chilly, but it's sunny, so that's good. And it's not snowy.
Right.
Let's talk a little bit about what the NII is. Now, we've had somebody from the, what would you call it, an organization or an institution?
Not an institution. We're an institute. We're a not-for-profit.
Institute.
Yeah, not-for-profit organization. That's right.
Okay, so we've had somebody on a few years ago, Dave Carr, had someone on talking about it. So maybe you can just refresh our memories here.
Sure, absolutely. Happy to. So the NII was set up about 3 years ago. We started in January of 2020. We're an independent organization, not-for-profit, set up by Bruce Power and some of the other big companies in the nuclear industry. Shortly after we started up with employees, COVID hit. And 6 weeks into the organization. So we kind of grew and were incubated during the COVID period. But the idea was that we would do a couple of things. The mission was to have an impact in the community and on the nuclear industry, because there's a lot of work going on up here, a lot of money being spent and a lot of people working, a lot of companies going on. And nuclear now, given the need to get to net zero and to fight climate change, is going to be a big player for decades to come. So there was a strong feeling that we really needed to do something that would leave an impact and have a footprint in the region here. And the NII was kind of the expression of that. So in simplest forms, we do a couple of things. One, we do some, you can think of it almost like internal work and external work. The internal stuff is industry projects that we work on, and that's what Eric leads for us. Really well. He can talk about some of the stuff we're doing in a few minutes. The other stuff was probably more visible to people, and that's the community work we do. And it's a huge, huge part of the organization, and that's everything from doing some STEM education and coding work with the schools right across the region to working on projects that can provide policymakers with guidance, like looking at electric vehicle infrastructure and the needs for rural communities to have good EV infrastructure if that revolution is going to come to us. To things like putting on public events, like the Swerve event that we held in Southampton last year, that brought new technologies up and let people of all ages, basically kids of all ages, I like to refer to it, to let them have a hands-on experience with virtual reality, with robots, with holograms, to drive electric vehicles, all those kinds of things. So it's a variety of things, but they're all very focused on the community. So those kind of two sides to us.
It's interesting, you know, that you did start up just as the pandemic, you know, was starting, because it does seem like a sort of a techie organization. So it was a real opportunity to make that work, to use technology, right, to be able to communicate with people and all of those things that everybody sort of had to get a grasp on.
Well, absolutely, Claire. And I mean, it was interesting because we were just getting going when COVID hit. And of course, that closed the schools right away. So one of the things that we did, and this is the origin of our educational programming, is that we decided we got to help people out here. What can we do? Just to give kids and teachers and parents a break and some relief from this. So we started doing coding classes, and they were incredibly successful. People really responded to them. We couldn't handle the volume of interest that was there, and we just kept adding new programs and more and delivering those to people. But what was cool was that we were able to do it. You know, we've got a facility over in Port Elgin, and the idea had always been that we'd have school kids coming in. Nobody could come in, so we went out. We built a studio that was effectively a mobile online studio in the back of the building, and we delivered the classes from there. So we were able to use technology to our advantage to be able to reach kids during a time when they were desperate for things to do. And that really spun off and became so successful that it was the foundation of our educational programming, and which has now turned to something what we call NII Explore. And we've gone from basically doing a stopgap technology-driven sort of short-term solution into something that is a key program at NII, and which is in all of the schools right across the region. We're now, not only do we teach coding, but we teach science, we teach electricity, we've been helping on all kinds of programs. We've run some special stuff for high school students, including a mission to Mars. A real space theme going to come out here today. You better be careful. But the foundation of that was in COVID and in our ability, I think, to pivot and to use technology to make things work.
It's so high. We're on AM radio right now. So, I mean, our listeners range in age, but a lot of our listeners, you know, would never have gotten even close to doing coding in school. That all of that is so, I guess, new, it seems, to the general education system. You know, unless you were to specialize and go into computer science or something like that, you wouldn't encounter it. I certainly never encountered it.
Neither did I.
In my head, it's a bunch of zeros and ones. I feel like that's wrong.
Well, you're ahead of the game.
You know what? In my head, it is too. Yeah, I've gone back to that. Yeah.
But the mission to Mars you mentioned, that was really cool. I actually, because that's one of the neat things about, you know, I won't say what came out of the pandemic, but, you know, was that you had access to meetings that you wouldn't have normally and that you could, you know, sit in on some things. And so I watched a lot of the mission to Mars.
Oh, did you? Fantastic.
Yeah, and watched the teams of students come up with their ideas and you know, the panel of judges asking them questions. It was really cool. We never got to do anything like that in school.
No, that's the idea. I'll let Eric talk about it because he designed it and delivered it. But just really good to be able to do something that is different for you.
Yeah, and I would add, like, to me, the most impressive piece of that whole March break camp was the fact that the students were so involved. I mean, we didn't ask them for all of this. The whole idea was, hey, you can come to this March break camp. I keep calling it a summer camp, but you know, you can come to this camp. We'll give you a couple hours of instruction, some activities to do, some questions to think about and answer. And then, you know, really, it was up to the students to see how much they wanted to do. And like, we were getting emails and Teams messages at like 8 at night, midnight a couple times saying, what do we think about this? Do you think we could do this? Like, they were so into it. It just made, you know, Philip and myself so much more into it. We're like, oh yeah, we have to make this fantastic. We have to make it everything it can be. So, and really, yeah, like Philip Craig was running those programs for us, and he just does a fantastic job designing these things and connecting with the students. And it's super fun to be a part of.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's an opportunity to use creativity and maybe a little bit of, I don't know, little bit of science.
Sure, yeah, you can sprinkle it in there. Yeah.
But imagination, and it kind of seems like that's something that, you know, the NII uses, just in looking at maybe a complex challenge from, you know, a sort of a perspective that people can understand. One of the things that comes to mind is I saw on Twitter, now there was recently this nuclear conference in Ottawa, and there are all these vendors that are at this conference, and the NII had a ball pit,
right,
which is very something we all recognize from the time we're little children, but it helped explain isotopes, which is just incredible.
Absolutely. Yeah, and again, Eric's best position to talk about isotopes, so I'll just talk about the ball pit part of it for a second, because that's where I hit my ceiling pretty quickly. But we try to do things differently a little bit, and we try to be on people's side, which is to say, there are a lot of complex things happening out there in the world right now, and help me understand them better. I may need to make decisions about choices for energy sources and to fight climate change, or I need to understand what's a medical isotope. We see our role as being on people's side, providing them with some basic science, basic facts, but also a really interesting, almost experiential way to learn about these things. So the ball pit is a perfect example. Medical isotopes, tough. Well, actually, maybe I'll turn it over to Eric to describe what it does, but it was just a different approach to describe what they are and what they do.
Yeah, and so specifically with that one, we were looking at there's actually a whole field of different medical isotopes with all different applications. But one of the ones that we've been talking about a lot lately is called lutetium-177. And that medical isotope is currently used for treating prostate cancer. And the way that it works is it's actually like given to the patient, I believe through injection right into the blood. But what it does is it actually I won't say it seeks out the cancer cells, but what we do is we bind it to a chemical that will choose to bind preferentially to those cancer cells. And so as it sort of traverses randomly through the body, when it finds those cancer cells, it will latch onto them. And that's when the isotope is able to do its work and cause damage to those cancer cells and shrink the tumors, eventually getting rid of them. And so that was the whole idea with the ball pit was, how can I give people the example of sort of searching randomly through all the cells, and all the balls in the ball pit are the same color, but what we have is actually magnets in a few of the balls, and your vest is magnetic. And when you actually connect with those ones, just like the target and the receptor on the actual medical isotope is doing with the cancer cells, it finds them, and when they do, they link together, and then they stay attached.
That's incredible. And you know what, this kind of reminds me that I haven't really given you a chance to introduce yourselves and sort of explain your backgrounds. You know, Bruce, you were talking about, and we sort of talked about simplifying things for people. Mm-hmm. Now that is in your background in terms of journalism, which takes, you know, sometimes a complex thing that's happening yep. and sort of boils it down for people to be able to consume quickly.
Yeah. Absolutely. A storytelling form. That is my background. I spent most of my career as a journalist. I worked at Maclean's magazine for a while, and then I worked overseas in the UK and across Europe and the Middle East and Asia for the Los Angeles Times for 10 years before ending up at a desk in Los Angeles for about four more. I think it prepares you well. It teaches you how to be a healthy skeptic about things. It teaches you how to ask questions and get to the right questions. And then it also, journalism teaches you to, it provides you with a good filter to decide what's important here and what's just noise. How do we separate signal from noise? And then how do we communicate that in a way that helps people understand something? Especially if you're working in other countries, you're trying to come things, you're explaining something to people, or you're trying to describe something to people that they can't see and feel. So you're trying to give them that sense of being there and describe to them what the world looks like from here. So again, you're trying to help people who are operating in dim light to try to see it better. And I think we could apply that to all kinds of things, you know, whether it's in business or anything else. But certainly in this role at the NII, I think brought some of that perspective to the work that we do. And to understand that the stuff that a lot of people, whether they're in any form, whether they're engineers or doctors, or we all talk in our own code, and we understand our own world so well, we often forget that other people can't follow us. And it's important to bring everyone along. I think that background has really helped sort of shape the kind of organization that we're trying to build. And we've got a really talented team, and everyone's really sort of bought into that. And I think that's helped define who we are to a degree.
Right. So as speaking of, you know, scientific backgrounds, Eric, maybe you can tell us a little bit about where you come from.
Sure. And I'll give you the short story because the long story is quite long. But, you know, always excelled in science and math. So what do? You go into engineering, right? That's, you know, makes sense. Did my engineering degree at Queen's University. When I was done that, I realized I wasn't quite done. I was looking for something else. And I came across this field called medical physics, where you actually are doing medicine, just, you know, much like a medical doctor would, but you're doing the physics or the science side of things, where you're saying someone has to design these X-ray machines, which is actually what I was doing when I took that program. You know, someone designs these MRIs, someone figures out how these medical isotopes work, how we can use them, how do we make them? Those are, you know, medical chemists and radiochemists. And so I did that. I got my PhD in medical physics and applied radiation sciences, which is quite the mouthful. But technically, yes, I'm a medical and radiation physicist. After that, my work, I was basically designing new X-ray detectors and X-ray equipment, focused mostly on breast cancer. And when I got my first job after that, I excelled at making radiation detectors, and so that's what I got a job doing. So I was actually working out of Chalk River, near a lot of the facilities up there, and I was designing radiation detectors for the Canadian Space Agency from time to time, but mostly for the U.S. Department of Defense.
So that kind of leads us into something we will talk about after the break, because you know, we're talking about what the NII has sort of done, but there is a big thing that's coming up that the NII is doing. Of course, if any of you listeners have have a question for my guests. The phone number is 519-376-7777, or you can call toll-free at 1-800-265-3757. You're listening to The Open Line on AM 560 CFOS.
Call and add your voice to the conversation. 519-376-7777. Now, back to The Open Line on 560 CFOS.
Good morning. You're listening to The Open Line. I'm Claire McCormack. With me today, our Chief Innovation Officer, Dr. Eric Johnston, and President and CEO of the Nuclear Innovation Institute, Bruce Wallace. We are talking about the NII and something that they have planned coming up very soon. They're going to announce it today. But first, we have a caller on the line. Let's go to Gord. Good morning, Gord.
Good morning, Claire. Morning, gentlemen. I've been recently been diagnosed with prostate cancer. And I'm looking for different avenues rather than the sort of standard treatment. And I'd like Eric to explain again about the medical isotope that's been developed that will attach itself to the CA cells and eradicate them. So if he could do that, I caught a bit of it, but he, like most scientists, he tends to talk fast, and an older man with a hearing loss doesn't catch things as well. So that's my question anyway.
Thanks, Gord. Dr. Eric Johnston, I'll give you a minute to explain some of that for Gord.
Sure, absolutely. And, you know, I'll start off by saying you should always take the advice of your doctor. I am not a medical doctor, and I'm not going to give you any medical advice here. But if you want to know a little bit more about some of these new medical isotopes, essentially what they are is a form of targeted radiation therapy. So similar to an external radiation beam, however, we actually attach the radioisotope, the thing that's going to deliver the radiation, to some specific tracer. In this case, with prostate cancer, you're actually looking at a very specific prostate protein that we can attach it to. And so what will happen then, somewhere in a lab, they will attach this radio tracer with the radioisotope. We're talking lutetium-177 today. And that will be injected into the body where it will actually go and bind to the prostate.
So hopefully that answers your question, Gord. And thanks very much for that. So maybe I can, I don't know if you'll be able to speak to this, but is that something that's being used today? I mean, would you go to your doctor and they'd say, you know, we're going to recommend that you go get this treatment? Like, but how do you access something like that? Are people using it yet?
It is being used worldwide. I'm not familiar with its current uses here in Canada. I know that I think Germany is leading the way on this new treatment, but it is being adopted more and more throughout, you know, all the different countries. Yeah.
It's something that, you know, I'm from Guelph, so I'm not from Bruce County, where, you know, people maybe grow up knowing about Bruce Power a little bit and sort of, you know, are near this, you know, nuclear operator. So you just don't learn as much, you know, if you're not
sure
necessarily from
yeah
the region. But it seems pretty neat that this whole isotope, you know, people think about it as generating energy, you know, nuclear power. Mm-hmm. But there are these other things that, you know, could make Bruce Power or Canada a leader, you know, with your lutetium-177, 177 or 177? How do you say it?
It doesn't matter.
Okay.
It is the number. Yeah. Yeah.
And what's the other one? Cobalt-60?
Cobalt-60 is another significant isotope created at CANDU reactors, the type of reactors we use here in Canada. In fact, we're a major player in the global scene of producing cobalt-60. And that's typically used for sterilization purposes in the you know, things like masks, gloves. You know, we use so many of them during the pandemic. They don't have to be one-time use if you can clean them. But unlike, you know, traditional chemical cleaning and things like that, it's not quite as convenient when you've got cloth masks and things like that. So Cobalt 60 is another form of sterilization where you can basically place the source and the things to be cleaned in a room, wait a certain length of time, and they'll be sterilized.
It's interesting, you know, just looking at how you can take nuclear technology, if that's the right terminology to use, and use it creatively to come up with these sorts of, you know, life-saving things. I mean, it's incredible. But one of the things that we should talk about, because, you know, you have a background in radiation technology, mm-hmm. is this whole other aspect. I mean, when people think about nuclear, for better or worse, they tend to think about radiation. Mm-hmm. And you have a neat project coming up.
Absolutely.
That has to do yeah. with outer space.
Yeah. So, you know, it's been 8 years in the making, and in no way am I going to take full credit for it. It was actually a collaboration between two other professors and myself that we all went to. Well, our main professor still teaches at McMaster. He was the one who was my supervisor, and Dr. Andre Hanu's supervisor as well. But yeah, it was myself and another NASA scientist now working at Bruce Power who developed this radiation detector technology that will answer a few of the questions that are missing about the types of radiation that astronauts are experiencing in space. And so we started this project 8 years ago, and it's finally going to space next week, hopefully.
That's pretty incredible.
Yeah.
So how is it going to get to space?
So it'll be launching from Florida, Launch Complex 39A at Kennedy Space Center in Florida, Cape Canaveral. And it's, again, it's slated now to go up on March the 14th. So assuming nothing else gets in the way, we should actually see the rocket launch. And it will actually be traveling on a resupply mission to the International Space Station. So what actually happens is it'll go up to the space station, the astronauts will get all their supplies, everything else, and then they'll kick out a few of these satellites that are being built.
Okay, so the thing itself, it's a satellite? What is it? Like, what are you putting in the...
Yeah, so the project was to build two things. It was to build the radiation detector and then the satellite that runs it, that controls it, that houses it. So it'll actually be a satellite that is thrown out basically the backside of the International Space Station, or ISS, if I accidentally call it that. But I'll try not to use too many acronyms today.
Yeah. Well, I think our listeners probably are familiar enough with the ISS, at least. So what does this thing look like? Is the size of a laptop computer, a lawnmower? What is it?
So it's actually these new sort of class of satellites, and I'm calling them new relatively, called CubeSats or nano satellites. And this one is actually about the size of a loaf of bread. And it's quite small, which makes it actually quite cheap to make. So it's really sort of increasing the ability for people to reach outer space. It's increasing the ability for these other groups to get either science equipment or even just engineering tests, right? To say, how can I prove this technology will work in space? Sometimes that's what you're doing instead of trying to do something brand new, a novel from a science standpoint. You're trying to say, okay, will this new type of radio work in space? Will this new type of computer work in space? Or will something out there cause it trouble?
So it's going to measure radiation.
Yeah.
Why?
So, you know, and we're all sort of hopefully familiar with the idea that radiation can be bad for you. The jury is still out about how bad it is and whether all radiation is bad for you. But that's not really the question I'm trying to answer, or at least my research team is trying to answer. We're trying to figure out what types of radiation are causing the damage that we are seeing when we go into outer space. And that's really, there have been lots of different experiments over the years, but we're really hoping to put a definitive pin into what kind of human-like doses, radiation doses, you're going to be experiencing, while also being able to, at the same time, separate out the different types of radiation because they can cause damage in different ways.
So this is, I mean, that sounds like a really cool and huge project. You mentioned, you know, what effects it has on people. You know, there's more radiation out there than there is here.
Absolutely.
In our open line studio. You know, we're doing just fine. So what I'm kind of am just reading a little thing. 200,000 to 300,000 times higher than a dental x-ray?
So that number is actually based on a trip to Mars. And that's kind of where we're thinking we're taking human spaceflight next. We're saying, okay, we've done the moon. We're actually going back to the moon. So we're doing that as sort of a staging exercise to say, how do we get to Mars? Can we land on another planet that is potentially hospitable to us? I mean, there's lots of years to get there, but the first step is getting there for the first time. But a mission to Mars, and it basically has to do with the way that the orbits line up, because as the Earth is rotating around the Sun, so is Mars, and at different speeds. And so it's actually somewhere between like a 6 to 9 month window to get there, a 6 to 9 month window to get home, and a dwell time. You have to stay on Mars for about a year and a half to 2 years, depending on how you want to line everything up. So that number of our estimate of how much radiation astronauts are going to receive is really based on a sort of 2 to 3 year visit to Mars and back.
And so I guess the goal would be to figure out a way to protect these astronauts, figure out how much radiation is there, you know, and then how to
absolutely
stop them from being exposed to it.
Yeah. And again, if you haven't gone down the rabbit hole of researching this, you know, if your only experience with radiation is getting an x-ray, maybe you'd say, okay, well, we put on the little lead apron and we're done. But the radiation in space comes in all different varieties, and it's much more intense. Even the x-rays that are out there are much more intense than you would find at the medical office. And so a thin layer of lead is not going to be enough. And so we need to figure out, again, what types there are so we can design smart shielding, maybe smart detectors to try and say, oh, there is a solar storm going on. Maybe we should expect a lot of solar particles go into this type of shelter.
Wow. I mean, how far away in terms of years do you think that kind of thing would be?
Surprisingly close. Oh. Yeah. We have done certainly lots of modeling and testing and understanding of space-like radiation fields here on Earth. We have the capabilities of generating like test facilities that would allow us to do this type of work. And we're already planning for it. It's really just answering a few of those uncertainties around, okay, we think the number is somewhere between, you know, 20% proton, 40% neutron. And I'm making these up totally, by the way. You know, anyone who is an expert, don't, you know, take it with a grain of salt. But it's really a question about what that mix looks like. And that's what we don't know just yet.
Right. Yeah. Well, I have plenty of questions to ask about this. But if any of you listeners have something you would like to know, you can give us a call and talk to Chief Innovation Officer at the Nuclear Innovation Institute, Dr. Eric Johnston, or the President and CEO, Bruce Wallace. The phone number is 519-376-7777, or you can call toll-free at 1-800-265-3757. We'll be right back with more Open Line on AM560 CFOS.
You can find the podcast version of today's broadcast on our website later this morning, 560cfos.ca. In the meantime, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Open Line. Claire McCormack here with you. And with me today are the President and CEO of the Nuclear and Innovation Institute, Bruce Wallace, and Chief Innovation Officer, Dr. Eric Johnston. And we are talking about a space mission, basically.
Absolutely.
So, now, we're talking about this, not a scientist or an engineer, so I'm just going to call it a device.
Sure.
That detects radiation, and it's going to be launched next week, March 14th, if all goes well, from Florida.
Yep.
Where did you build this thing?
So, most of the construction occurred at McMaster University. That's who we were partnered with. That's where all of the investigators, we all went there. Dr. Bune, the primary investigator, still works there as a full-time professor. And then, as I had said a little earlier, it basically was born out of a friend of mine, Dr. Andre Hanu, who was working at NASA at the time, but is now working up at Bruce Power. And the the team, actually, the nice thing about this project is it was a student-run project. Sure, we may have had the initial idea to build this radiation detector, and that was our expertise. So we guided that, and we helped the team do that. But we actually had a team of about 200 students working on this project over the eight-year window. And they're really the ones who put this whole thing together, managed the team themselves. We did actually quite a poor job managing things, as you might imagine, three scientists putting in charge of a large group of people. But yeah, I mean, it was great opportunity for them. They got to put their hands on this, you know, design it, build it, test it. And now for the team members who are still on the team, and actually the alumni as well, anyone who wants to, they're able to go see it go to space.
Wow. So yeah. They can go down to Florida.
Absolutely.
Well,
yeah.
This is a great time to go to Florida. Yeah. Love to be there right now. We have Pat who is on the line. Let's see what Pat has to say. Good morning.
Good morning, Claire. Good morning, Eric. And is it Bruce?
Yes, it is.
Morning. Yeah.
I got a real backwoods dumb question from an uneducated person. That does a microwave oven run on, does it create radiation, and does the food coming out of that oven then not that you eat have radiation in it?
I think that's a great question, actually. And I mean, today what we'll be talking about is a certain field, a certain type of radiation that we call ionizing radiation. And that's the radiation that can cause damage to your cells in the sort of way that people are thinking, imagining, you know, damage happening to your DNA. And that's the stuff we're looking for in space. When we look at our microwave oven, it's actually using radio waves, believe it or not, the same thing that you're probably listening to this on. They're very concentrated. They're contained in that little box. That's why microwaves are sort of fixed sizes. They actually sort of bounce back and forth in there. And all they do actually is warm the food up. They just cause the water in your food to heat up.
Right, but wait a minute. That is it heated up with radiation?
And then
the radiation then would go into the food, and when you take the food out that's hot, is the radiation still in it?
No, the radiation actually just causes the water to heat up, but it doesn't actually stay within the food.
And it's sure
also
of that one?
I'm certain, yes. And it's also non-ionizing, so it couldn't cause harm to you.
Okay, and you're with the Bruce Nuclear, are you?
No, we're with the Nuclear Innovation Institute. We're an independent.
Okay, yeah. I was going to give a heads up that Bruce Nuclear is one of my favorites in this community because it's done so much for the community. So that's one thing. But no, the microwave, I keep thinking of that thing. I mean, if it's radiation that heats it up, it's got to, it's like chemicals in plastic. When your food's wrapped in plastic, I swear to God, the base of that's oil, so you're absorbing whatever's in the plastic. But you're on the radiation side, and I do thank you for answering my question today.
No problem.
Keep up the good work and have a good day.
Thank you.
Yep. Bye.
Thanks, Pat. Pat brings up a couple of interesting things. But the first one, because so you mentioned that it's a different kind of radiation. The one that you want to worry about, if I'm heard you right, is ionizing.
Yes. Wait,
and that's not what microwaves have. So does that mean when they tell us don't stand in front of the microwave, that's just not really, I still don't stand in front of the microwave. I don't know. Is that a myth?
In some ways, yes and no. Microwaves, just like everything else, can start to leak over time. In fact, some people have noted that if you have a really leaky microwave, your Wi-Fi in your house may go out, because Wi-Fi actually uses microwaves of a similar frequency, not exactly the same. It's not going to heat your water, but close enough that they can interfere with each other. It's always best to avoid the radiation, even if it's non-ionizing. It still can cause some very localized heating, which, of course, is what we use the microwave for. So if it leaks a little bit, then you would actually, again, you might potentially get a little bit warmer. But we're talking, 10, 20-year-old microwaves, so.
Yeah. My microwave's very old. I thought it looked cool. I got it from the Salvation Army. I thought, this is neat. It's chrome. Okay, so one of the other things, though, is that there is naturally occurring radiation everywhere.
Absolutely.
And isn't all food and all, like, everything's radioactive a little bit, right? You should be able to find some, am I wrong, existence of radiation.
Yeah, no. I mean, I just... I as a scientist, I avoid using things like all.
Okay.
I could imagine there could be some food that is non-radioactive. But the point of your question, I think, is that yes, radiation is naturally occurring. It has been with us since the formation of our galaxy. We experience most of our radiation from the Earth itself. Again, from the rocks and the minerals and these things that are just naturally radioactive. They have been for, again, millions, billions of years, and they will continue to be radioactive. And then our significant source here on Earth is also space, typically coming from the sun. You know, the most common form we're used to seeing every day is the sunlight, right? I mean, it is a form of non-ionizing radiation. But we know, even as simple as getting a sunburn, we know that ultraviolet light can cause damage, right? And so that's kind of that disconnect that you see sometimes is like, oh, we see that the sun is streaming all of this radiation towards us, but, you know, people don't necessarily put it together that, oh, some of that radiation is in the ionizing category. And it's, again, as for as long as the sun has been here, it has been giving radiation to the planet.
Right. So something that, yeah, don't necessarily need to.
You've never lived without. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's actually so hard to block out what you call background radiation, the fact that radiation's all around us, that we run some experiments at a place called Snow Lab,
mm-hmm.
and that's where you're trying to block out all of the background radiation so that you can actually see how things behave in an environment without any. And to get that, you've got to go 2 kilometers underground through Laurentian Shield bedrock, I think it is,
yeah.
To basically be able to block that out. So, that's one of the few places on Earth where you can actually work and be exposed to zero radiation.
Probably, and I don't know if this is entirely true, but it is definitely one of, if not the lowest radiation point on the planet in these facilities. And we can do some very exciting experiments there because all of life on the planet has been growing, has been evolving in the presence of the radiation from the planet and from the sun. So what happens to life if you take that away? That's not quite sure.
Right.
Yeah.
Don't take the sun away.
No.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit more about this sort of this space mission and its goal. And you mentioned, 6 to 9 months to get to Mars.
Yep.
You'd be there for a year or so and then 6 to 9 months to get back. So if you find some astronauts, and I don't know any astronauts, so I don't know what they're willing to do or how long they're willing to leave their families for, mm-hmm. or be, confined in a space with a few other people for like two or three years.
Yeah.
But then you've also got to protect them. I mean, mm-hmm. when you talk about this place on Earth without any radiation, you know.
Yeah.
It seems like a difficult thing to find.
Yeah.
So, and you talk about, if the radiation levels are high, for example, and there's some sort of solar storm, then you mm-hmm. say go in this pod. Like, what? It's not made of lead, I would guess. Like, what do you?
It depends. Again, it will actually depend on what the type of radiation is. That's why it's so important to figure out what the mix is, and the mix is actually in constant change. It's in flux because when the sun is very active, it's streaming a lot of these particles. We call them solar particles, and they're generally these charged particles coming away from the sun and occupying our local region of space. But the sun actually goes on a cycle, and when the sun is acting very calm, then it's actually the radiation coming from different galaxies, the galactic cosmic rays, we call them, that are the predominant radiation source. And the mix of those two, the makeup of them is very different. And so you actually, along with the launch windows and timing everything else, you're going to be looking very closely at the sun cycle and trying to decide, okay, is this a big sun activity period? Is this a low sun activity period? And should we be using that again to design our shielding, to design different vessels, places we can put astronauts?
Wow. Because, I mean, I guess the idea is to be able to have just people in general, maybe one day, mm-hmm. be able to go to Mars.
Yeah. Yeah.
So eventually it's going to have to be like something anyone could wear or do or go to. I mean, that's a long way away, I would think, that part of,
Yes, but I think like one of the nice things is when you get to the planet, and same thing when you get to the moon, you have some rocks to work with, right? And so just as Bruce was saying, when you go 2 kilometers into Snow Lab, down in Sudbury, you actually block out a lot of that radiation. Well, you can do the same thing. And that's one of the major plans at Mars, is they're looking at these lava tubes. They're kind of holes that have been carved out. And if we can put the astronauts in there and put the settlement in there, then we can use the natural formations to our advantage.
Wow, that's incredible.
When Eric describes this, like living in lava tubes and going through radiation fields and galactic stuff, it just makes me think we better take better care of this place.
That's true. Yeah. Well, you know, it's a good point, and it sort of it can bring us back to Earth and back to what the Nuclear Innovation Institute also does, and nuclear power and kind of, you know, on the break we were talking about this. I think maybe people who live in this area or who have grown up in this area, and Bruce Power has been there for, you know, decades, view it in a certain way, whereas someone in, you know, maybe a different country where nuclear power isn't maybe the main source of energy production sees it differently. You know, people are afraid of things like radiation and, you know, I don't want to say, I think there's a fear and maybe it's not necessarily based on data, a logical thing on what could go wrong, you know, should there be some kind of nuclear accident? An accident can maybe even be, you know, not the right word to use because there are all these safety measures in place that, you know, prevent those things from happening. But that's kind of something that I would imagine the Institute does, is gets messaging out. You know,
absolutely. Well, just as we were talking about radiation, trying to talk about it in normal terms, the recognition that it's a normal occurring thing, and, you know, in big doses it's not great for you, but it's something that we live with. Similarly, we want to talk about nuclear power in a normal way, because to date it's been defined by, to a certain degree, by popular culture. It's been defined by Homer Simpson, and it's been defined by movies and television shows that sort of raise, that are sort of great entertainment, but aren't reflective of the reality of it all. And I think nuclear power has sort of suffered from that over time because it was unable to define itself as sort of in the important role that it plays. It's allowed others to define what it is. And the opportunity now arises for people to take a look at nuclear power because of the imperative of resolving, of doing something about climate change. This planet's getting hotter all the time. We've burned fossil fuels for 150 or more years now, and they've given us all kinds of great benefits, but they've also produced something that is potentially catastrophic for at least the human experience on Earth, on the planet. Nuclear power produces massive amounts of energy with no greenhouse gases, none. Zero, and that's an absolutely vital thing to have going forward as we look at how are we going to power this planet, how are we going to keep the lights on in the studio, in hospitals, how are we going to run our factories and keep the lights on in our homes,
the electric vehicles, right? As we switch to more electricity,
exactly. All this, we want all those things, and yet we can't continue to burn gas, and we can't continue to burn oil and coal. So nuclear power steps in as a source that, as we know up here, it's in Bruce County, but, you know, a lot of people may not even know where it is, and a very, very tiny footprint produces an enormous amount of energy. 30% of Ontario's electricity comes from the Bruce Power Plant just down the road, and you can't even see it. And it's doing all that without producing any of the greenhouse gas emissions that are warming the planet right now. So it becomes indispensable. And it's we think it's time to talk about nuclear power in a normal way, and to talk about the benefits.
We need to take our last break. We have about 8 minutes left when we come back. If you'd like to get a call in, the phone number is 519-376-7777, or you can call toll-free at 1-800-265-3757. You're listening to The Open Line on AM 560 CFOS.
The story behind the story. We now return to The Open Line on 560 CFOS.
Good morning. Welcome back to The Open Line. I'm Claire McCormack, and with me for about 5 more minutes, our Chief Innovation Officer at the Nuclear Innovation Institute, Dr. Eric Johnston, and President and CEO Bruce Wallace. So you're launching this thing into space next week, right?
Yes.
How long is it there for?
So it'll depend on what kind of trajectory we get when we leave the International Space Station, but it should be somewhere between about 9 months to 2 years. And at that point, it will basically just fall back into the planet and burn up in the atmosphere.
Oh, wow. So yeah. Collect all the data from it and then
beforehand.
Say goodbye.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we've got Walter on the line. Good morning, Walter.
Good morning, everybody. Now, you said as far as pollution, there's no pollution with nuclear energy. I agree, and I also disagree. The problem is the waste product, the town will burying it in the ground, probably over by, where is it? Doesn't matter. They're going to try to bury it anyway. Mm-hmm. What about a fission? If they ever develop fission nuclear reactors, will they not burn that?
It is possible, and there are types of reactors that are able to burn what we call spent fuel. But it's by the time you are done using CANDU fuel, because we start with natural uranium, we don't do any of this enriching process. It is a rather weak energy source. And so I think what you're hearing is that, you know, the NWMO has been tasked with finding the safest way to contain it and to look after it for the rest of time.
I know they're working on smaller reactors for the north and that, which would make more sense. I imagine they're quite costly, but fission lines aren't cheap either, and burning fuel.
Yeah, and certainly these smaller reactors that are being developed, we call them small modular reactors, or SMRs, and they are sort of a turning point for the industry where they said, okay, we need something that is cost effective, that it can be deployed quickly, and then also can actually reach out to these remote communities, because they are running on diesel right now, and they need some way to switch off of that. If we're all going to switch, they also need some method to do it. So
they were talking about maybe putting a nuclear in the tar sands out west there. Would that is that dead in the water, or is that still on the table? Or
it's probably not the first choice. It's probably some time away. I think the oil industry was interested in that. But Walter, the big challenge is that we're going to need so much more electricity, and it's got to be clean. You know, when you look at pathways with, as Eric said, you know, with all the electric vehicles we're going to need and ways to keep powering them, you know, the estimates are that we're going to need 2 to 3 times more electricity in this province just, you know, within a couple of decades. So to get there, you really need large sources of energy generation. Small modular reactors are interesting, but they're small.
Yeah.
And we need massive amounts of energy. So,
problem with the government putting all their resources behind electric vehicles is a joke. It doesn't even make sense if you think about it. We live in a colder climate. Electric vehicles do not work very well in the cold climate. I have a hybrid, and it does not work very well in the cold climate.
Yeah, it's a challenge.
And that's, I mean, there's new technology, again, sort of coming down the line. People are working on batteries that work better in the cold, increasing distances and lifetimes, but also things like hydrogen vehicles, where we say, okay, if we're going to burn a chemical fuel, what if we burn something that, again, doesn't emit these greenhouse gases that are currently causing our planet to warm?
Thanks very much for your questions, Walter. We've got about 1 minute left. So I guess I just want to ask, can we watch some of this launch? Like, what happens with this thing?
The launches are televised. NASA usually has a live stream that you can go on. I know I caught the last launch on YouTube, and yeah, you can watch these things go up. And otherwise, come in person and head on down to Cocoa Beach and watch. Yeah.
There you go.
Well, SpaceX.com.
SpaceX.com. There you go.
It's a Falcon 9 launch. So yep. SpaceX.com. It's on in my house pretty much every other day.
There you go. So Steve will catch it. And hopefully you'll keep us updated on what you find, you know, a year, 9 months down the road.
Absolutely.
That's all the time we have for today. I want to thank you both very much for joining me.
Well, thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah.
The news is coming up next. You're listening to AM560 CFOS.